I'm Alex Hotta. You guys probably saw me just a couple minutes ago. Excuse me for the mild technical difficulties on the projector here. In this breakout, I'm going to talk about some basic vetting techniques that we're using and that our customers are using and we're recommending for internet sharing recipients. The problem statement, if you will, is anything scripted or theatrical, you're looking at a high piracy risk, right? Sharing outside your company is this special case. It's always there because it's in the post-production workflows, it's in the pre-release publicity windows. You gotta share out. In post-production, it's usually who we're sharing out to here is cast members, VIPs that demand to use their personal email address, sometimes vendors and contractors. And in pre-release publicity windows, as we were just talking about a few minutes ago, the biggest problem is this extremely wide audience. Mistakes in this process can be extremely expensive. And so what we're steering toward doing is making something that's not too complicated. It doesn't require you to have an extremely large investment in a team, processes, expensive tools to do this. We're looking at doing a light touch, quick process that pretty much any team should be able to implement so that you can get this to the front lines, the people that are actually doing the invitations. Train them up with the awareness they need. And what they need is some tools, some processes, and they need support from a good content protection and security team on their back end, okay, to back them up. When I'm talking about vetting, I'm talking about an onboarding process of getting somebody into a sharing system. Whether it's sort of the first time you're doing an ad hoc share with them, or you're inviting them to your press screener, and they're gonna have standing access to some stuff. And usually what this process looks like is something like this. You gotta read through it. They're requesting access. And this can happen a couple different ways. Sometimes you're getting a bunch of names from a consultant, and you're putting them into your system, or you've acquired, you know, a sharing workflow from another part of your organization or another organization entirely. But usually there's some kind of moment at which you're entering them. And the person who's doing that, in my example here, it could be anybody, but in my example, I'm gonna talk about a publicist who works for the studio or works for the content owner who is interested in sharing that reviewer. What I'm recommending is that the publicists are become aware of this vetting process beyond what they're doing today. And we see tons of different activities in vetting, but I'm gonna boil it down to three facets that are the basic categories. And I'm gonna present sort of entry level stuff for each of those categories that I think anyone can implement. And then if you need more, maybe you can go beyond that and put whole teams and whole tools around each of these. The first one is you need a list of known bad actors. In most internet sharing, this is going to be a list of email addresses, but there are other technical indicators you might want to keep, IP addresses. In some cases, there's a device ID, whether it's a cookie or a hardware device ID. The next piece is email domains, and this would apply as well to other technical indicators, but if we just focus on email, those email domains are a really important indicator, and they're often all you have to go on. And the third piece is snooping people's online presence. And within each of these categories, if you do a reasonable level of vetting, I think you'll catch in that net the vast majority of suspicious requesters. And then the way this flows is, this goes, you know, the publicist either does or initiates some research in each of these areas. It comes back to the publicist with hopefully a good result. They grant access to the reviewer and they're off to the races. I'm gonna add some more to this diagram later because obviously I'm not done. I'm still gonna watch what they're doing. But let me talk through each of these spots. So, list of known bad actors. Your basic technique is maintain a central list of known bad email addresses and email domains, but like I said, this can apply to other indicators. You want to maintain a list of your known bad IP addresses. Maybe it's VPNs or hosted infrastructure. We maintain that list based on observed behavior. We also trade these. We sort of swap and trade them with each other when we find new stuff or when we and we have confirmation or even just a strong suspicion that something is not quite right with a given user. So based on whatever intel you can get on that, and I'll come back to how to get intel on this on a later slide, keep this list. Next, make that list available to most people. And that can be difficult, okay? The entry-level version to make this available to publicists, but also the admins of the system, also your support personnel, who might be contacted and might be on the front line of the social engineering attempt. What we did was we made this tiny little internal webhead that our staff has available to them. We nicknamed it Hawkeye. It's just a cute little name so we can train people up in it. All of our support staff, all of our customer success, which is sort of like client service staff, certainly everyone in content protection who's touching content protection on the security team, as well as our salespeople, are all trained up in how to use Hawkeye. And it's so simple. You just paste in your email address and click verify. The whole box turns green. Go ahead and talk to the person. Red immediately escalates to security. Or yellow, which is, probably want to wait till tomorrow and talk to us during business hours. And let's proceed carefully before we go. So that's like our little internal tool at Shift, the way that we chose to surface this to those users. But really, this could be done in a variety of different ways. One of the things we're looking at now is rolling that actually into the ad workflow on the tool itself. You can get into some sticky points when you're looking at putting that in there. So for example, we may have, we may put something in Hawkeye that's, let's call it a little trigger happy. If one of our customers comes back to me and says, we removed this person because we're not sure who they are, or there's any question at all, of course we put them in Hawkeye. Hawkeye's the first line of defense against social engineering or any kind of manipulation of our staff. And the only thing that's going to happen if they're in Hawkeye is that it's going to get escalated to the content protection team and the security team. And we can snoop them further, go back to the customer, ask for additional research, and we can vet them ourselves. So we're happily, you know, very low bar on getting something into this list. Behind the scenes, we do also keep our PC in there. It's dates, and it's a little bit bigger data store in the database. Any technical IOC store that you're using, any of the commercial products out there have those kind of capabilities. It's also possible to do this from a little database table, Google Doc, you know, Google Spreadsheet. Microsoft Stack has great tools to just stand something up quick like this. Okay, so and that was basically our approach. We were able to, we're a web development company, so we made a little tiny little web app and put it on our intranet. Who's doing something like this now? Your people that are sharing the content, whether it's publicists or like the interns that run that one account, who's got a tool like this in-house now? Show of hands. So that's my first recommendation. This is obviously not, this takes time to do, right? But I wanted to talk about it first because everything I'm going to talk about after this kind of depends on having this data and having it available to you. Second facet, what I call email domain research. So again, focusing specifically on the email indicators, which is the one that's most familiar to the sharers and also the first one that you typically get. We set out some ground rules. When at all possible, prefer emails with specific domains. You're always going to get the VIP ones in this email. It's going to happen. You can't entirely avoid it, but if they have a work email or if they have a personal email that's on their own personal domain in some way, try to get over to it. The other thing is prefer a work address over personal address. We see a lot of press users in screeners.com that are added sometimes by different content owners, sometimes by the same content owner, the multi-tenant system. Under both addresses, there's some people have three addresses. They have a work, maybe like a trade group email and a personal email, or two different personal emails. It gets to be a bit of a mess. It looks to us like maybe they might be sharing or oversharing because somebody's walking out back in at the same place. My advice is prefer their work email address. If you're inviting press users, put them on their work, put them on their work email. And then here's some of the techniques we use for vetting those email domains. So the first one, and again, this is kind of a mixed bag of tricks, okay? But these are things that you may or may not be aware of that we've actually found really, really fruitful. We've shared with some customers that are working on building these capabilities, and they've also found that these things can work. So Threat Crowd is kind of like a technical indicator wiki almost. It's got shared data, and basically the question that Threat Crowd is able to answer is has anyone else who's using Threat Crowd flagged this indicator? In this case, what we're really looking at is we're looking at that domain. What's the IP address? Where is it hosted? Etc. And Threat Crowd will often show up on ones that we already considered suspicious. The next one we use this little tool called Security Trails. Security Trails gives you historical information. And critically for us on email domains, it includes historical DNS records. Has the hosting moved? It's one of the questions we want to answer. Because you'll find something that's hosted, I don't know, you look it up, it's hosted on Amazon Web Services or Azure or something. And that could be legit. We'll have their email on there. Real corporations have their email domains on there. But if it moved and it used to be in free hosting in Berlin or Central Europe or Canada or anywhere, really anywhere in the world, but especially if it's on a free hosting service and out in the US, that's a huge red flag. Now, as you can tell, I'm about to get more technical. It's already technical. Already, you're not going to have a publicist in there using these tools, right? This is going to require some support from a central team like security or private protection. We're going to use Whois, this new domain registration, dig in or NSLookup, and really look carefully at where the thing is right now. We use this one little tool called URL Crazy. That will look for similar URLs, similar root domains, in order to try to see if we think this is similar to another domain, which is one of the techniques that the con artists are using to try to impersonate. And the OSINT framework has a bunch of open source tools, some of which are useful here. So we're watching that closely. We're regularly looking around and stuff. So normally, as I said, this requires some technical staff. The important piece of that is you need to combine this with that central list, right? When someone enters a new unknown email into Hawkeye or posts it in the central list, or when they actually add it to a system, as they add it, preferably before they add it, but also maybe immediately after they add it, before the share has been consumed, we vet the new domains just as they're added. We look up anything new. We try to figure out, is that the real company? Is it a real company at all? And disallow the emails that are clearly on fake domains. Anybody have any questions here before I move on? You guys understand the technique on recommended. Super cheap. Everything's basically free or maybe double-digit dollars. We're talking about super, super cheap in terms of dollars. A little heavier on the processing. And then third, we're going to snoop their online presence. So what we're usually looking for in our experience here is we're trying to figure out, are they actually a reviewer of what they're being said? If it's TV, are they a TV reviewer? In some cases, some of the fake impersonators were signing up for TV reviews, but they're really film reviewers. Like art house film reviewers. Not out of band. That's probably as close as it can get that I've seen that it's an imposter, and it doesn't look like it's an imposter. But we've also seen impersonation of journalists who review other stuff that's kind of related and it would be plausible that they might have TV screeners. So theater reviewers, culture reviewers, product reviews, not a general reporter. If they're covering city or regional news in somewhere in the country, they're probably not supposed to be getting TV reviews. And anything else unrelated, we're going to scrutinize them a lot deeper, potentially either push back on the team or get further into it. And what are we used to do this? Some of this stuff is going to be the usual suspects, right? We go to Twitter first. Every single writer, if you're talking about journalists, every single writer tweets constantly. And you can see what they're tweeting about. And if they're not tweeting about TV, they're probably not a presser anymore. Or at least, they can wait until next week. Because they're not on the deadline to write a review for this property. The next one is LinkedIn. Again, it's kind of obvious, but most of the press reviewers can be found on LinkedIn. Almost everyone can be found on LinkedIn, except for a certain tier of VIP. Also, it's sometimes hard to find security people on LinkedIn. You guys know that, probably, kind of avoiding having a public profile. Journalists never avoid having a public profile. It's not a thing. One of the things we found with LinkedIn is that you can, if you add these, set up a Gmail address or a specific address, email address on your work domain, you can log into LinkedIn and use the feature that connects your address book. And essentially, LinkedIn has this sort of side channel search by email address. If you have someone who you find on LinkedIn and you search for their email and it doesn't bring up the same person, huge red flag, okay? That's probably a fake email. And reach out to them. You can reach out to them on LinkedIn. They'll answer you. They'll probably answer you. They'll appreciate that, you know, the process you're going through is valuable. That stuff, as I said, leaves out VIP users. So a lot of the stuff gets shared to, you know, executive producer at an entertainment-related publication or something like that. We typically do find those people on IMDb, and one of the things we're looking for there is what do they work on, what are they actually working on? Because if they're working on something that's completely unrelated to this property, at least we know that it's probably just like a courtesy VIP viewing scenario, and again, they're probably not on that deadline at that stage. You don't want to tick them off, but it gives us a little more room. And then the other one that we use a little bit deeper, and again, it's like totally, you know, inexpensive and easy, is TruthFinder, which is public record search. We're going to look at where they're located. We can potentially look at their phone number. It sometimes freaks people out, but we sometimes call them on the phone number and get them. If it's really suspicious, we can find their physical address and correlate that with activity. You can monitor them after the fact to make sure they're in the, they look like they're in a residential address, but why are they in Cameroon? They don't live there. Which brings me to where the monitoring fits. So, once they're in the system, once you've vetted them, we still have to do kind of activity monitoring on that system. And very importantly, this team then has to maintain that list of known bad actors. That's the only way that you can really close that loop. So any question, totally trigger happy, put them in the database, comes back to the security team every time. So what we'll see is that these people will go to the support channel, and they'll fill out the sales form, and they'll talk to the sales team, a completely different story, and then they'll come back again to the support team. Get them into your central stopping point. Also, for content protection, you guys heard me talking about, we do a lightweight verification. We do a video verification that we were reusing from multi-factor reset. If you have anything available to you like that, that can be extremely useful. Because again, a legit reviewer, or a legit VIP viewer for that matter, who wants to view the content, will happily jump on the call with you. If you tell them, like, look, it'll be less than 10 minutes, I can get you into the content now. If you don't mind that I do a video call and record it. Again, it freaks people out, but a lot of times they appreciate it. We don't record. Sometimes we will relax the recording requirement and or show your ID requirement, and it's just a quick little video call with no recording. If it's a VIP, who we can actually recognize from their public profile, and we know who they are, because they're like a famous actor or director or something. And that's basically the process as we're putting into place. Additional best practices, it's really important that we cooperate between vendors and customers, between partners, all of the groups. If you guys aren't in the Content Watch Slack group that was set up by the Hootie folks, you should get in there if you're doing this kind of work and you're looking for this kind of vetting. That's really extremely useful. LA size, right? Hopefully soon we can move all this into a media and entertainment ISAT or real structure and technical indicator sharing. As an industry, I think we're not quite there. We're approaching it. We're not quite there the way that, let's say, the banks are with anti-money laundering or something like that. But we could get there if it's worth it for us to save on the staffing headache, cleanup, as well as the direct revenue loss. And then the other important thing is that we clarify the legal constraints on sharing this stuff, because the more we can share, the better we'll all do. Especially when we find out that somebody already knew that this person was a bad actor or a research. So that's my story. any questions, guys?
Yeah, so hi, my name's Tracy and I work with content protection, and I receive a lot of content for the to create fingerprints. To prevent anti-piracy. And so my question is more towards like software, what kind of software to use to like share files, and keep them protected. Because I find myself, really sharing files internally, but it is from like business group to business group, where it's like, we don't always, we're not always in the same location.
Yeah. Well, okay, so there's a couple things we can do in that category, and I don't know if your mileage may vary on these, but one of them is our system has secure sharing of video. So we use that. That's the first thing. The next thing is we'll have to like email it around, even to like a public email, but we'll encrypt the file. Kind of similarly to the way our pen testers send results to us. We'll encrypt the file, and then we'll share the password through a side channel, like Signal, for example, or we'll share the password through, there's this one tool called OnePie, one. YME, which is, it's a commercial or free product. We thought of running our own instance, but if you find a one-time password sharing tool, then it's a better breakaway to share those files. So you're talking about like one-off sends at that point, not not ongoing sharing.
Yes, although I am coming up on that issue more internally within the team, and like right now we're just file, but like, or a USB drive, but like, what if that USB drive gets lost,
Yeah, we also turn off USB drives on our machine, so that could fall apart. I really like the idea of using the tools you have to share content, because if you can get a count on there, you know that meets your spec, right? Mm-hmm. What we're sharing is basically the tool that you care about.
Yeah.
Sure, that's good.
Alex, what's your approach to freelance critics that don't have domains?
We'll still put them in there, they have Gmail address or whatever, with their company name or something. We still put them in there. Part of it comes back to that monitoring, because on the monitoring side, we're able to snoop their actual activity. We can see parallel sessions. We can see people that move around the country or the world too fast. And I think at that point, you've got to go over to the compensating controls, because you're not going to vet random Gmail. And they're not going to, just because we want them to, they're not all going to set up their own email domains, right? So that's probably my best answer at this point.
When you conduct these snoops into people's real life identities and try to find them online, are you logging that information, or is it a one time, make sure they're who they are, and then throw that information out? I'm just curious from a
From legal, a process standpoint?
Well, from a legal perspective and meeting GDPR and California's data privacy law.
Definitely applies.
Okay.
Yeah. We keep it out of the actual tracking. We do track it. So we're using, for example, Jira tickets. We use a ticketing system for part of these things. If it's initiated by them in our support ticketing system, we use Zendesk for that. We will continue it in Zendesk and maybe shadow it Jira without any actual indicative data. So to a certain extent, our content protection folks and security folks are trained up to not what not to put in there. In theory, we did talk about it, like in the GDPR removal, that we have to go and expunge that data, and at that point, we're just, if you can search it, you can expunge it. If you can't search it, then you can't search it. But yeah, we are using ticketing systems for that. Usually what we do is we do it in screenshots. So at least it's not searchable, it's in an image. We often can trace it back if they also came through our support ticketing system.
So, if you talk to Chris Taylor, who is up in the ISAC, because we've had discussions about, because we're all independently doing all the things you're doing, I've done portions of, and I think everyone else, so it'd be great to go to aggregate that. And then Chris Taylor has talked about building this database industry wide so that we can all feed our information.
And he's got a threat, what's it called, Threat Connect?
Threat Connect, yeah.
Got a Threat Connect instance. I think we should do it.
Yeah, I think so. It's because it's really valuable, like, the, you know, when the incident happened, they're able to be able to compare from different studios, similar vectors and similar behaviors.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
How we're able to, you know, flesh out.
To find the shared indicators and tell you if there's a suspect.
Sorry, just real quick, I know we've got 1 minute. How do you deal with the... So this is great for press recipients. Obviously, the guilds are a lot more different when you have to issue 100,000 codes in the wild than verifying that. Do you have any relationship with the guilds, or how do you deal with the hard problem?
Again, 100% on compensating controls. They will still try to share the login if they want to watch with a friend. And so we can turn them off and back on again. We can systematically disallow that design a shared session. Let's talk to the guilds and get through. I think we're out of time. Thanks, everybody.